This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There are two Republicans and three Democrats duking it out in this primary campaign season to become their party's candidates for governor of Vermont. VPR is interviewing all five candidates on Vermont Edition over 2 weeks, so voters can make a more informed decision when you go to the polls on August 9th. Today, we're joined by former state senator and former U.S. diplomat Peter Galbraith, a Democrat. He served in the state legislature from 2011 to 2015 after serving for many years in diplomacy in areas including Afghanistan, Croatia, East Timor, and Iraq. Now he'd like to be governor. Today on the show, we'll talk about his plan for Vermont. Peter Galbraith, welcome back to the show.
Jane, good to be with you.
You've said that you believe there is a way to move forward with publicly financed health care coverage, and this is one of the key issues that you'd like to highlight in your campaign. This is despite the fact that the current governor set that as one of his largest priorities and failed. What specific ideas do you have for controlling costs and making sure Vermonters have access to quality health care?
Well, first, I don't think failure was inevitable. The problem was that the governor came forward with a plan to provide universal publicly financed health care, but he didn't come forward with a plan to pay for it. And in fact, I think I'm the only elected official in the state of Vermont to offer a legislation to pay for it, which was there was only one way to do it, and that was with the payroll tax. At this point in time, I think we need to approach that goal incrementally. I think there are three ways to do it. One would be to provide universal publicly financed primary care. That would save primary care doctors a lot of time, so it would increase the amount of doctor time available. And it also would mean that Vermonters would get to see their doctor sooner and possibly head off more expensive procedures later. Another approach would be to put everybody 26 and under Dr. Dinosaur. I would say do it with no premiums. That would mean that people who were getting health care wouldn't have to get family plans. They could have single or couples plans, or you could have a subsidized public option on the exchange. Each of those options would cost around $250 to $300 million, and they could be financed with a 2% payroll tax paid by the employer who would get the business deduction. So that is the start of a path forward, and I think we should continue down that road.
How would you get a payroll tax through the legislature? I mean, this is another thing that Governor Shumlin has suggested. He wanted to have a payroll tax to address the cost shift in Medicaid payments to doctors, and that did not get traction in the legislature. So how would you finance a 2.2% payroll tax to get this public option?
I think that there are 2 points. By the time that Governor Shumlin had made that proposal, he really had lost a lot of credibility on the health care issue for having campaigned so hard on single payer, you know, the guy who would get tough things done and then abandoning it. And second, his payroll tax, I think, was hard for people to understand. What I'm talking about is something that would provide a concrete benefit basically to all Vermonters. All Vermonters under 26 and under would have free health care. All Vermonters would have free primary care, or Vermonters who use the exchange would find a public option that was much cheaper and better than the one that they would get through the private plan. So, you know, there would be a connection between the tax and the benefit, which was really not there with what Governor Shumlin was proposing.
We're talking with Peter Galbraith. He faces two other candidates in his fight to be the Democrats' candidate for governor in November. He's part of our Meet the Candidate series of interviews. And listeners, if you have a question for him about his top issues, including immediately raising the minimum wage, funding college education, and financing a public option, as we've been talking about, for health care, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts and questions for the candidate on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Peter Galbraith, one of the other major points of your platform includes raising the minimum wage immediately to $12.50 an hour with a gradual increase to $15 an hour. And you argue that this would improve the bottom line for Vermont across the board because it would also improve the lives of low-income Vermonters and require less money to come out of taxpayer pockets for social services. Why is this such a priority for you?
There's nothing bigger that we could do to make Vermont affordable for those who find it the least affordable. For whom is Vermont not affordable? Not the people who make a lot of money. Their taxes go up a little bit. It really is not going to make a big difference to them. But if you're working for a minimum wage, which in Vermont is less than $20,000 a year, well, it's very tough to get by. It's tough to provide childcare. It's tough to find affordable housing. And we have these long discussions about, for example, providing affordable housing where, you know, a few million dollars might make a few units available. But the way to make housing affordable, the way to make life affordable, is to pay people more. And so what I'm proposing is going to $12.50 immediately and $15 by 2021. That represents a 50% pay increase for those who make the least. It's going to make things more affordable for them. But there are benefits for everybody. First, low-wage workers spend a very high percentage of their extra income. They spend it locally, unlike wealthier people who may spend it out of state. So there's a boost to our economy. And finally, taxpayers basically subsidize low-wage employers through things like the earned income tax credit. So if we ended up raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, we would save $18 million in taxes. And that would go a long way to fund another plan that I have, which is to provide free tuition at the Vermont State Colleges for all 4 years, which would cost $28 million. But right there, $18 million comes from raising the minimum wage.
Before we get into that, and I do want to address that issue of education and your plan to have free tuition, but on that question of raising the minimum wage, of course, opponents argue that employers won't be able necessarily to afford that immediate increase or an increase to $15 an hour and will either cut hours for some of their employees or lay off workers if the minimum wage is raised, effectively making employees' incomes either the same as they were or no income because they've been laid off. So how would that balance out with your plan for decreasing the need for social services by raising the minimum wage?
Well, the fact is that most low-wage jobs are service jobs these days, and they need to be performed. You know, no matter what, you can't load somebody on a ski lift at Stowe from New Hampshire. You're going to have to do that in Vermont. You can't flip a hamburger in Hinsdale, New Hampshire, and serve it in Vermont. So I don't think very many of those jobs are going to go away. And the experience, actually, in states that have raised the minimum wage is quite often that their unemployment rate goes down. In New Jersey, for example, raised the minimum wage. Pennsylvania across the border did not. And in fact, unemployment in New Jersey went down after raising the minimum wage. So I think, sure, there'll be some businesses which will find it difficult. But the reality is that so many more Vermonters will win and the state as a whole will win.
Well, and of course, unemployment and underemployment are two different things. And we often find in Vermont that underemployment is as significant an issue, if not more so, than unemployment.
Sure. Again, I think we address the problem for paying people well for the hours that they work. And of course, many people who are working not just one job, but two or three jobs and finding it next to impossible to make ends meet. We talk a lot about government programs to combat poverty, and of course that then is paid for by every taxpayer. Raising the minimum wage is something that actually saves the taxpayers money and does more to combat poverty than anything the state could do. The state doesn't have a lot of surplus resources, which is why so much of what we do doesn't really have a big impact. You know, beyond providing for the basics, education, roads, environmental protection, we don't have extra money the way the federal government does, which, of course, can borrow as it did during the stimulus period.
Let's go to Kate, who's calling in from Milton. Hi, Kate. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
I want Mr. Galbraith to know I totally support the elevation in minimum wage and the employer's argument that they won't be able to afford it. If they would get more out of their employees and better quality work if they would pay these people something that is worth going to work for. But the main reason I'm calling is the people, the parents who have these adult children who are mentally ill and drug addicted have no support. We have senior citizens living with violent, mentally ill adult children where they can get absolutely no help. I know personally a friend of mine called Howard Mental Health 42 times in a month and got no help for her son until he was so psychotic that they had to take him to Berlin. And I would like to know what his plans are to help these people who are in dire straits trying to get help for their adult children.
Kate, thanks for the call. Peter Galbraith?
Well, thanks, Kate, for that question. And I will say that raising the minimum wage, making everybody better off, will go some distance toward addressing that problem. But the real issue, I go to a number of candidate forums, and what you hear all the time is, well, when the question of opiate addiction or these kinds of questions come up, we need a more robust mental health system. We need to do more on prevention. We need to do more on education. And then the candidates don't say anything about how they're going to pay for it. So if you're not going to address how you're going to pay for it, you really are not doing anything meaningful. And I'm prepared to talk about how to pay for it. I will have a proposal tomorrow that will eliminate $45 million in special interest tax breaks that will save ordinary taxpayers $45 million. These are things that no working Vermonter makes use of. They're sold to us as if they would promote economic growth, but they don't. And that will provide money for education, but it also will provide additional resources to address the problems that you're talking about.
And that plan, you say, is going to come out tomorrow?
Yes.
All right, we'll look for that plan. You mentioned, Peter Galbraith, that one of your one of the campaign promises that you're making is to establish a plan and to try to get a plan put forward that would have free tuition at state colleges for Vermont residents. What would that do for Vermonters that isn't currently in the way that we finance higher education in this state?
Well, you know, Bernie Sanders, when he campaigned for president, he talked about free tuition at public colleges and universities. And we can actually do that in the state of Vermont to make the five Vermont state colleges tuition-free for all Vermont high school graduates would cost about $28 million more than what we currently spend. And so I will outline how you get there. But, of course, you get up to $18 million simply by raising the minimum wage and no longer then having to make those payments under the earned income tax credit. There are other special tax breaks that have no rationale except that the powerful lobbyists got them. I'll give you one example. If you go to your auto store, auto parts store, and you buy a new carburetor, you pay a sales tax on it. But if you're wealthy enough to have a private airplane, you don't pay a sales tax on the parts for your airplane. That cost us, the rest of the taxpayers, $1.1 million. And there are lots of things like that. You know, it's a choice. Do we want to subsidize rich people and their private airplanes, or do we want to subsidize public education? And the reason why this is so important, and there are about 8,000 Vermont high school graduates at the Vermont State Colleges, is that college is the pathway to a much better employment future. And one of the cost is a major deterrent. The tuition at the state colleges is about $10,300. And that means that somebody coming out of the state colleges will have a debt of up to $43,000. And what does that mean? It means that person is not going to be able to buy a house. It may affect such basic decisions as whether to start a family. And that's just not right. I think we will do much better investing in education than, frankly, in supporting people who like to fly around in their private airplanes.
You mentioned some tax loopholes that you think we shouldn't have. Is there any tax or fee in place today in Vermont that you would take steps to repeal as governor?
Oh, there are many. First, I cited the loophole that allows you to buy airplane parts without paying a sales tax, whereas you would on, say, auto parts. There is an exemption from the sales tax for products you buy on the cloud. And that costs taxpayers $4 million a year. The legislature just put that in. So if you buy the product at Staples, you pay the sales tax. If you buy it on the cloud, you don't pay the sales tax. How did this get into place? It's because the cloud companies, hired lobbyists in Montpelier, and they argued if Vermont got rid of that sales tax, it could become a technology hub. Well, they made the same argument at every other state legislature, and I can guarantee you not every state's going to become a technology hub. We have an investment tax credit that actually subsidizes investments in coal. Why would we do that? It doesn't make sense. We have a research and development tax credits that are additional to the federal tax credit. They're intended to promote research and development, but the reality is they simply reward investment decisions that have already been made. And again, when you award people a tax credit, it basically means you're raising the taxes on everybody else.
Yeah, but those are different than repealing an actual tax that's on the books or a fee. I mean, closing a loophole or removing an exemption or removing a credit is different than removing a tax that's already on the books for people.
Sorry, I think I misunderstood your question. No, I wouldn't be repealing taxes that are on the books, but the one thing I would do is to transfer some of the property tax to the income tax. I served on the Senate Finance Committee, and in fact, there are seven members. I got three on my amendment, which would have eliminated the pass-through of the federal itemized deductions. That would have taken about $70 million from the income tax, put it in the education fund, and we would have had no increases in income in property tax over these last 6 years if it had passed. But it came one vote short.
So is that one of the ways that you'd like to relieve pressure on the way we currently fund our public education system by moving some of that pressure from the property tax to the income tax and sales tax?
Absolutely. I represented Windham County in the Vermont Senate. And the tax that my constituents hated the most is the property tax. And I understand it. You've got to come up with a large amount of money. The ownership of your property is at risk. And so I think we ought to listen to Vermonters. We can lower the property taxes by transferring it more of the burden of education to income tax, which is the case in most other states. It's a more fair system. Those who are better off will pay more. That's the whole point of the income tax.
Do you believe that Vermont needs to consolidate schools or school districts?
Well, this is an interesting question. I don't think we actually have a crisis in education funding. 40 years ago, my girlfriend at the time taught at Leland and Gray High School in Townsend, and she actually was from out of state, from Virginia, although not a Southerner, the Washington suburbs. And the students thought of her as a pretty exotic person. 40 years later, in that same high school, they teach Mandarin, and the kids go to China in the spring. So, yes, we're paying more. We have 50,000 fewer students, but we're still paying the same 5% of the state GDP as we did in the 1970s. We're just providing a lot more opportunity for young Vermonters. So again, I didn't think we had a crisis that required consolidation, but now, of course, consolidation is underway. I think we need to be very flexible about it. I'm skeptical of many of the cost savings that are proposed, partly because some of these small school districts pay their teachers much less than the larger ones. When they're consolidated, of course, you have to raise the salaries of the teachers from those smaller school districts.
Now, Secretary of Education Rebecca Holcomb would say it's not just about cost savings. The idea of district consolidation and even school consolidation would be opportunity for all kids. So not all of them are learning Mandarin, presumably.
No, and certainly there's a lot of romanticism about the one-room schoolhouse, but it didn't always provide quality education. So, yes, to the extent that consolidation provides better opportunities, that is a good thing. But it seems to me that this ought to be left to the local communities. And one of the things that we're losing in consolidation is the extraordinary involvement of school boards, essentially of volunteers, in our education system. I mean, Vermont is an extraordinary place for the number of people who actually serve in one way or another in public service, basically as volunteers. And so when we consolidate, we're losing a lot of that involvement, some of which we now will end up paying for. So I think that's another loss of the consolidation process. But where communities want it, where there are better educational opportunities, yes, there's an argument for doing it.
We're talking with former Windham County State Senator and former U.S. diplomat Peter Galbraith. He's running for the Democratic nomination for Vermont governor. And if you have a question for him about how he plans to address the state's energy needs while stopping industrial ridgeline wind, or his vision of the right direction for Vermont, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Peter Galbraith is a former Windham County senator and former U.S. diplomat. He's running for the Democratic nomination for Vermont governor, and he's our guest today in the second of five Meet the Candidate interviews on VPR with the leading candidates for governor facing primary fights. If you have a question for Peter Galbraith, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Nathan writes, Mr. Galbraith, can you talk about your position on gun control? Do we need more gun control legislation in Vermont?
Thank you. Yes, I think we do. I think there's no logic in having background checks and then allowing private sales to take place without background checks. Obviously, if somebody isn't qualified to buy a gun through the background check system, they are going to do it privately. And that defeats the whole point of the system. And the second thing that I'm in favor of and have called for is a ban on military-style assault weapons. As a diplomat, I served in Croatia and Bosnia during the war, as well as in Afghanistan. And I saw firsthand what the consequences of these weapons. They are not sporting weapons. They are not useful for self-defense. They are basically useful for killing large numbers of people, and these are the weapons, particularly the AR-15, that has been used in one mass shooting after another in the United States.
How do you define assault weapon, though? There are a lot of questions about what an assault weapons ban would actually mean.
Well, this, of course, would be something that one would work out with the legislature. But basically, it is a weapon that has a large magazine that can shoot off a lot of bullets in a very short period of time, an automatic or semi-automatic weapon.
So would ammo restrictions be more along the lines of what you're going here for in terms of large magazines, large capacity magazines? That's where the real ban is?
Well, I think it is also on the type of weapon. But yes, I think on large capacity magazines and even on certain types of bullets, for example, armor-piercing bullets, they're prohibited from being manufactured, or imported into the United States, but they can still be sold. These are cop-killing bullets, and it makes no sense to allow their sale.
Do you support the legalization of marijuana, and what would your policy look like if you become governor?
Well, I'm not in favor of the use of marijuana, and if the question was, should Vermont Vermonters be using marijuana, my position would be no. But the reality is that Vermonters do use marijuana. And so legalization is not about increasing the use of marijuana. It's about legalizing something that has already gone on, where prohibition has not worked. And so I am in favor of legalization. I think there are three main advantages to legalization. First is that it actually will be easier to keep marijuana away from young people. Young people today can find marijuana much more easily than they can obtain alcohol, and that's because it's not regulated. Second, when you're buying marijuana on the black market, you don't know what it is you're buying. You don't know the purity of it. You don't know the power of it. If it's sold through licensed outlets, there'll be regulation and buyers will know they'll get a safer product. And finally, it should be a source of revenue to the state. These transactions are going on and the state is getting no revenue at all. If it's legalized, there'll be more money into the coffers of the state for essential public services.
Let's go to Andy, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Andy. Go right ahead. Your thoughts.
Hi. Thank you for tackling all these tough issues. I wanted to ask you about wind development in Vermont, and I just make a real short statement and then ask you to clarify your sort of blanket opposition to what you call industrial wind. As I drive around Vermont, I see cell phone towers on mountaintops, ridge lines, all over the place. I'm looking at one right now. As I drive around Brattleboro, we have telephone poles, power wires tangled all over every street in the town. There was a time in Vermont where all these wooded hillsides were cleared for raising sheep. I don't understand, if we're not going to have Vermont Yankee and we're not going to flood huge areas of Vermont for hydroelectric power, one of our natural resources is wind passing over our ridgelines. our family has a joke. Whenever we see windmills, power-generating windmills, we always say, oops, unsightly windmills. But we don't mean it. We always feel proud that there is indigenous production of power going on. And I just would like you to explain why you've made a blanket opposition to significant generation of electricity through wind power on Vermont ridgeline.
Andy, thanks for the call. Peter Galbraith?
Well, first, we have a problem as a world, and it's global warming. Along with nuclear weapons, global warming is the biggest threat that we face to human survival. Nuclear weapons would eliminate civilization instantly, and global warming is something that is coming along over time, and it will have the same impact if we don't address it. But that doesn't mean that every solution makes sense for the state of Vermont. And my problem with industrial wind, and I'm not talking about small-scale wind projects, I'm not talking about community projects, I'm talking about these gigantic projects that go on top of Vermont ridgelines, which are done by huge multinational utilities, is the environmental damage that these projects do. And if you could simply parachute the turbines or helicopter the turbines onto the ridgelines, then the impact would be mainly visual and people could have a debate about that. But in order to get these turbines up, you have to build enormous roads going up the ridgelines. You have to blast away the top of the mountains to put in the platforms. This destroys places that are the most pristine places in the state, very often the areas that were never cleared, and which are also very important for wildlife habitats. And the end result is energy that is not green. I don't think Vermonters quite understand this. Basically, the utilities sell the renewable energy credits out of state. And so the wind projects, they're not allowed to say that they're green energy because they are not. Basically, they're sold to Connecticut utilities and Connecticut industries so that those industries can continue to burn fossil fuels and at the same time call their energy green. And they can do it without having to destroy their precious Connecticut hills. I don't think that Vermont hills should be the, if you will, the dumping ground so that Connecticut hills can remain pristine. But there are other forms of renewable energy that I think are very important. First, the most important investment that we can make would be in efficiency and conservation. You get 10 times the carbon reduction for every dollar that you invest in efficiency and conservation as you do in other forms of renewable energy. And, of course, there are no adverse environmental consequences to the kilowatt to not generating energy, as there are with other forms of energy, including renewables. Second, I'm in favor of buying the Connecticut River dams. Those would meet about a third of our base load, and so we would be substantially on our way to toward meeting our goals of 90% renewable by 2050. And yes, those dams did damage, but they're already environmental damage, but that damage was done a century ago. And then I'm in favor of solar, but it should be, of course, properly sited. And there's no reason why it can't be sited in accordance with Act 250 and the town plans.
We got a note. It actually came in on Reddit during your AMA, and all five of the candidates who are on our Meet the Candidate interviews are also doing Reddit AMAs or Ask Me Anything. And this was from someone who is using the same handle, confusingly, as one of the editors generally posting favorable updates on your Wikipedia page. But somebody going by the name of Western Civil asks this pointed question. How can Vermonters trust you when you say you support renewables but amassed a fortune from Middle Eastern oil deals and oppose an entire renewable technology? I think referring there to ridgeline industrial wind.
Well, I've explained my position on industrial wind. I think it is environmentally harmful. And my role in Kurdistan basically has been to help the people of Kurdistan, the country, to get two things they want and that I think they should have: their own independent country, and with that, the resources to sustain it. And if it were not for the fact that Kurdistan's developed its own oil resources, it certainly would have been overrun by the Islamic State, and the atrocities would have been many multiples worse as to what's happened already.
But you also did make quite a bit of money off these oil deals, so you were profiting off oil deals.
Yes, I had a profit-sharing arrangement with a company. In fact, the company never made a profit, but it broke the contract, so naturally I pursued it in court, and I won a breach of contract settlement. But it was certainly very generous, not nearly as generous, unfortunately, as what has been reported.
But the suggestion there, I guess, is that you benefit from fossil fuel deals. So there's a question, at least in this user, of how to trust you on the idea of pushing forward renewable energy.
Well, more broadly, obviously, fossil fuels are going to be part of our economy for some time to come. I suspect that person who wrote probably drives a car, and that car is probably powered by gasoline. So the question is, more broadly from an environmental perspective, is where the gasoline should come from. If you take it from fracking or from oil sands, you do a lot of environmental damage. If you do it in the Middle East, particularly in Kurdistan, the environmental costs of extracting the oil are very low, and as I said, it also helps and oppress people obtain their independence, which I support. I might add that if I actually initiated the successful effort in the Vermont Senate to ban fracking. So I'm no friend of the fossil fuel industry. As I said, I led the effort to ban fracking, and my effort was opposed by the American petroleum industry.
Peter Galbraith is a Democrat hoping to be his party's candidate for governor of Vermont. Peter, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Jane, great to be with you.
This interview was part of VPR's series of Meet the Candidate interviews ahead of Vermont's August primary. On Wednesday of this week, we'll be talking with Republican candidate Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Matt Dunn and Bruce Lissman are also on the show this week, so if you have questions for any of them, you can send them our way. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net. Coming up, giving credit where credit is due, in this case to a stonemason who spent some formative years in Barrie and is finally being recognized for his contributions to Mount Rushmore. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There are few more impressive combined engineering and artistic marvels in this country than Mount Rushmore. One of the individuals who had an integral role in its creation was its chief carver, Luigi Del Bianco, an Italian immigrant who spent some time as a stonemason in Barrie. But while the mastermind behind Mount Rushmore, Gutzon Borglum, received ample recognition for his role in Mount Rushmore's creation, Del Bianco's name was overlooked for decades. Author Douglas Gladstone has a real problem with people not receiving the recognition they are due. That's why he's written Carving a Niche for Himself, The Untold Story of Luigi Del Bianco. I asked Gladstone to describe the Barrie of 1907 that Del Bianco would have found himself in.
Of the 12,000 people who lived in Barrie at the outset of the 20th century, about 4,500 of them worked in the granite industry. That's why even today Barrie's unofficial nickname is the granite center of the world. So when Del Bianco's cousins told him, and he was a young 17-year-old in Meduno in the Italian province of Pordenone, he said, look, if you want to apply your trade, come on over to America. There can be a lot of work for you here.
So he came over to Barrie in, I think, 1907. He's a teenager when he gets here.
Yeah.
He was in his 40s when he gets to do Mount Rushmore.
Yes, and
okay.
In between, he has the good fortune of making the connection with Gutzon Borglum through his brother-in-law. He fell in love. He had gone to Italy to fight for Italy. And he comes home to Portchester, New York, falls in love. And it's fortuitous that his brother-in-law introduced him to a friend of his in Stamford, Connecticut, Gutzon Borglum. And Borglum even allows him to live at his home in Stamford, takes him under his wing. They work together on such projects as the Wars of America Memorial in Newark, New Jersey. And then Mount Rushmore commences in 1927, but he was not asked to join the South Dakota Project, as it was called. It was only until 1933 when Gutzon Borglum fired the first chief architect, a gentleman by the name of Hugo Villa, that he called for Del Bianco to come on out to Keystone, where the memorial is located.
And Del Bianco actually had to fix some of the problems that Hugo Villa had created?
It's a funny story. The first task that Del Bianco is given, his first instructions are to blow the Jefferson face off the top of the mountain. Now, Hugo Villa was only acting under the instructions given to him by Guts and Borglum. And if you're looking at the monument, it's from left to right, Washington, Jefferson, Teddy Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln. Well, that's not how it actually began. The Jefferson head was initially placed to the right of George Washington, and it was in an area where there was really uncarvable granite. And Borglum happened to be coming home from a trip to France, and he happened upon two travelers looking at the work. And I guess, anecdotally, the wife turns to her husband and says, "Why is Martha Washington up on that mountain?" That's what the Jefferson face apparently looked like initially. So his first instructions to Del Bianco was blow that face off the top of the mountain. And ever since, of course, it's been correctly positioned, as we now know it, to the left of the Washington head.
Yeah, so if you're looking at the monument, it looks like it's to the right of Washington, but it's over Washington's left shoulder.
That's correct.
Del Bianco then basically takes on the role of chief carver. What else did he do for the project?
Well, it's interesting you say he takes on the role of chief carver, because in spite of the fact that Guts and Borglum's own correspondence in the manuscript division of the Library of Congress clearly indicates in a July 30th, 1935 letter that Del Bianco is indeed a chief carver, the National Park Service never recognized Del Bianco. And I have always maintained, and so has the Del Bianco family, that, well, how can you go against Guts and Borglum's own words?
Mm-hmm.
It clearly says in this July 30th, 1935 letter, "I've appointed Luigi Del Bianco chief carver." Isn't Del Bianco's words good enough for you? The government's position has always been that Del Bianco was just a worker. He was a day worker. Guts and Borglum was commissioned. He was the person who the United States government had hired, and everyone else was essentially a subcontractor. And, of course, that's true. There were 400 people who were working at Mount Rushmore from 1927 through 1941, 399 men and one woman. And in the annals of history, they all receive the same historical recognition and credit, irrespective of their jobs. Now, this is the heart of the Del Bianco family's assertions in my book. How can you give and accord the same recognition and credit to Guts and Borglum's stenographer or the party who ran the elevator lift as you can to Luigi Del Bianco? Luigi Del Bianco would sit in a bosun's chair 600 feet up in the air. The hoist engineer or Guts and Borglum's stenographer did not have their lives imperiled by doing this type of work. So it's a very egalitarian position that the government has always abided by, but I have always maintained that it's just not fair. It might be egalitarian, but clearly you can't expect to have the chief carver go down in the annals of history in the same way as Guts and Borglum's stenographer. The letter, in fact, clearly says he was doing finishing, he was roughing, he was carving the features. And in fact, Del Bianco was most proud of the fact that the pupils in Lincoln's eyes, they came alive. And in fact, I've always loved Mount Rushmore because as a youngster, my late parents gave me a Viewmaster. And one of the slides that I put in was Mount Rushmore. And wherever I looked, it always seemed that those eyes were looking directly back at me. And that's what Del Bianco was most proud of, the refinement of expression he was tasked with. He did other things. He patched a crack in Jefferson's lip with a foot-deep piece of granite held in place by pins. But his pride and joy was always the pupils of Lincoln's eyes.
You mentioned that he didn't get the credit he deserved for being chief carver, but in fact, just recently, the National Park Service has sort of corrected that omission, right?
Yes. A lot of the advocacy that the Del Bianco family, the Order of the Sons of Italy in America, my publisher, Dr. Anthony Tamburi, our imprint, Bordighera Press, and myself, a lot of the pressure we have applied to the National Park Service saw the fruits of our labors, and we realized we remedied this correction last month. And it was not a lot of fanfare. This is the 75th anniversary of Mount Rushmore, and it's being celebrated all year. So Mount Rushmore, on its Facebook page, has been putting little biographies of some of the workers. And there it was, simply said, Luigi Del Bianco in the bio, was chief carver beginning in 1935.
So you feel somewhat vindicated and on behalf of the family and all those others who have been striving for this for so many years.
I've got to tell you something. I have been called many things throughout the last 2 years. I've been called an instigator. I've been called a troublemaker. I've been called an agitator. But do you know what I've never been called?
What?
I've never been called wrong. So, Jane, yes, I definitely feel a sense of vindication.
Douglas Gladstone is the author of Carving a Niche for Himself, The Untold Story of Luigi Del Bianco. Well, summer school is back in session. Each year on Vermont Edition, we have a series of segments teaching something fun or interesting. Only very occasionally do we teach something practical. This year, we kick the series off with a lesson in archery. Now, this is a sport that gets a lot of practice at this time of year, since learning to shoot a bow and arrow is a staple of summer camp programming. If you want to get a jump on your practice, here's Melinda Laban of Hubbardton. She teaches archery classes at the Middlebury Recreation Department, right on the edge of a busy playground.
The basics of shooting a bow, they're very simple. I use recurve bows because they are very basic. You don't need much knowledge to start with one. So you would stand with your feet pointing to the side with your left arm toward the target. Then you would extend your left arm out toward the target. Load up your first arrow. Make sure there's no one standing in front of you. You extend your arm out toward the target. You're going to grab your string with three fingers, just the tip, one finger above the arrow and one finger below. And then you pull back all the way to the corner of your mouth, plant your hand against the side of your face, and you're going to let those fingers loose. My top distance is probably 30 yards with decent accuracy. The reason I chose traditional archery is because I feel like the compound bow has too much going on for little kids. So I really kind of focused it down to what the basic things we could do to propel an arrow across the yard here for the kids. And it would be, you know, simple and something they could do and something that they would succeed at. Because if you get a kid out here and they never hit the target, they just kind of get angry and don't want to come back. I think the biggest benefit is that it's a kind of an individual sport. A lot of sports like soccer, baseball, they're super good for kids for learning team ethics and team work. But with archery, they can really focus on the way they stand, their body awareness. They can find, you know, something that they might be good at on their own terms. And, you know, you don't have to be hitting the bullseye every time to be successful at it.
That was Melinda Laban teaching us how to get a bullseye, or at least to hit the target. VPR's Melody Baudette produced that piece. Next week in summer school, how to make your own paint out of rocks. And that does it for today's show. Tomorrow, how a change in agricultural practices can improve water pollution in rivers and lakes. We're going to look at the principles of no-till agriculture and cover cropping and how they might impact water quality for the better. You can send your questions, comments, or better yet, your experience with no-till ag to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. And a reminder that for the rest of the week, we'll be talking with candidates for governor. We've got Phil Scott, Bruce Lissman, and Matt Dunn still on the table. And you can ask them any questions you have. So go write to vermontedition@vpr.net to post a question for any or all of those candidates. And do go to vpr.net. As we have these interviews, we are updating pages with what the candidates say, so you can actually compare and contrast on specific issues like gun control, like health care. And you can find out what each candidate says before you go to the polls for the August primary. That's all at vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. We have production assistance from Jake Burstein. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.